Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we're talking to Professor Carl Spracklin from Leeds Metropolitan University in the UK about his new book, Whiteness and Leisure. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This episode, I'm talking to Carl Spracklin from Leeds Metropolitan University about his new book, Whiteness and Leisure, which is part of a new book series published by Palgrave Macmillan called Leisure Studies in a Global Era. And we're going to talk a bit about the book. But to begin with, it'd be really great if you could introduce yourself to the listeners to the podcast just by giving a bit of background on your academic work, and particularly your work in leisure studies.
Okay, well, my name is Carl Spracklin. I'm a professor of leisure studies at Leeds Metropolitan University, which will probably be Leeds Beckett University by the time this podcast goes out. I've been there for about 10 years now, researching leisure in all its glory, from professional sports all the way through to music subcultures, tourism, and popular culture. And I've always been interested in critical sociology and kind of Marxist, post-Marxist theory, looking at the ways in which leisure is both a space for realization, exploration, and the construction of identity and community, but it's also increasingly a leisure space that is controlled by corporations, controlled by hegemonic interests, and where people's agency is actually very controlled and limited.
Yeah, and this comes through almost kind of exactly in the book, actually, which covers, I guess, the full range of the areas of leisure that you've been interested in. From things like sport, music, through to sort of everyday life. And obviously those kind of critical sociological theories that you mentioned. But before we actually start talking about the book, it'd be really interesting if you could say a little bit about the book series that it's part of, this Leisure Studies in the Global Era that you're co-editing with Karen Fox from the University of Alberta.
Yeah, the book series... Like all book series, is no doubt. The idea actually came from an editor at Palgrave Macmillan, Philippa Grand, who suggested that we put a proposal together for a leisure study series alongside a series that already existed on sport in a global era. She was keen to kind of... push leisure studies because she felt it was a kind of a niche that Palgrave hadn't really kind of explored, but it was something that she felt they should be exploring. I argued to her and to Palgrave that leisure studies should be reaching out to cultural studies, out to sociology, out to regional studies, all those other kind of areas where leisure studies had perhaps been kind of diminished and had kind of been marginalised, or people thought leisure studies wasn't actually a serious part of their subject field. So I've always been trying to kind of push leisure studies into those other subject fields. And I think with leisure studies in a global era, it's about saying the old leisure studies is dead. And there's a kind of a new leisure studies, a kind of a critical leisure studies that isn't just interested in running a leisure centre or figuring out the best way to put on some community sports activity, but actually it's asking these big questions about popular culture and capitalism and globalisation.
And the book really does do exactly that, actually, both in terms of its kind of theoretical approach, and then also kind of getting into those big questions as applied to different forms of leisure activity. I guess the interesting place to start with the book is that in the introduction you described that it's about how whiteness is kind of constructed idea about how it's challenged, how it's redefined in various different ways. And I suppose the thing that's really, you know, the kind of the obvious first question is, so what is whiteness?
Well, whiteness... it's continually constructed in discourses, in contestations over boundaries, in the development of imagined community and symbolic community, and in the kind of the struggle over who gets to decide who belongs and who doesn't. Whiteness becomes a kind of a metaphor for all the trappings of power that are kind of carried by the same kind of elite group that has been around and controlling the kind of the global networks since the 19th century. So essentially we're looking at the global north. We're looking at what in the book I call the kind of the Western hegemons, the kind of the imperialist and post-imperialist American and British political communities that still control the world, that still have huge influence in popular culture and culture more generally.
I mean, it's really interesting that you attempt to link, I guess, what we think of as kind of everyday experiences of cultural consumption, and then these broader theoretical questions around how ideas of race or ethnicity are kind of actively constructed by the activities of both people and corporations.
It kind of comes through, I don't mention this in the book, but when I was younger, I still enjoy watching the program Red Dwarf. And it struck me at the time, when I was a child, that this comedy program Red Dwarf was doing something really kind of unusual, because it had, for those who don't know, Red Dwarf had two black actors, and the lead comic character was black. One of the supporting characters was black, and this is quite unusual at the time.
Yeah, and this is sort of the late 80s, mid 90s.
Yeah, this is kind of the late 80s, early 90s. And when I read the kind of interviews with the writers and the developers, and they said, you know, they made this deliberate attempt to kind of fight this stereotype, it kind of made me realise, even back then when I was a teenager, that popular culture is a way of kind of reaffirming racial supremacy, racial hierarchies, and it's a way of making both whiteness normal but then invisible. So it's always a white actor who's the main actor in a film or in a television program. The kind of the assumptions about history are all based on white history, and where non-white discourses and non-white identities are at work, they become exotic and they become othered. And I took this interest in the construction of race into my PhD and my work on rugby league, and that then took me into looking at racism in rugby league, and rugby league being a northern working class sport dominated by working class white men, and how it was used to kind of construct their identity at the expense of any other alternative identity.
And this, I guess, is grounded in the first of the two major theoretical ideas or bodies of literature that you're drawing on, which is critical race theory. I wonder if you could say a bit about sort of what that is and why it matters in thinking about whiteness.
Well, I think critical race theory deconstructs kind of white privilege and the privilege of white academics to be unreflective and uncritical about their own position in performing whiteness and supporting this racial hierarchy. So I'm keenly aware, as an academic, to kind of step back and point out to leisure studies, point out to cultural studies and sociology, that often we kind of avoid this. It's the elephant in the room. You know, whiteness is so ingrained in everything that we do that no one really wants to kind of talk much about it. It's the same way that radical feminists would critique the gender order, and I see critical race theory as using the same kind of tools and methods. So it's partly kind of ethical, partly methodological, and partly theoretical about what you say about race. So race does not exist. Race is not a biological construct. It's not anything essential. All that it is a myth, a narrative that holds power. And it's how what we do as academics to help kind of expose this that I think is the important message of the book. It's a very polemical book because I want people to go out and question whiteness more widely and talk about whiteness more widely.
Yeah, and that kind of act of questioning or act of discussing is about, overturning the idea that whiteness is normal, is something that can be taken for granted, and that ideas of blackness or other forms of ethnic identity are somehow exotic or strange or need to be kind of, you know, studied as other or different.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, pathologized. And it's really interesting the kind of the attempt the book makes to sort of shine a light on whiteness, something that is taken for granted. Much has been done with studies of kind of masculinity or heterosexuality, you know, these kind of powerful categories that are seen as taken for granted.
In the conclusion, I actually say you could have taken hegemonic masculinity and put that in the book instead of hegemonic whiteness. I could have had an entirely different book, but talking about the same kind of inequalities and the same struggles over power and meaning and agency. Now, so, yeah, I agree with you.
What sort of, I guess maybe the other thing you're trying to do in the book is within some sections of critical theory, not just critical race theory, but critical theory generally, there has been a sort of an attempt to pull apart, destabilize, to, you know, maybe play with some of the grand traditions and ideas about universalism or common human experiences that have come to us through Enlightenment thinkers. But in the book, you're really attached to and really kind of defend particular forms of Enlightenment ideas, most notably the work of Jürgen Habermas, who is a German critical theorist who writes, you know, very much in the tradition of critical theory on the one hand, but also the Enlightenment on the other. And Habermas, in the book, you talk about how you've developed a sort of longer-term project about Habermasian approaches to understanding leisure and the influence of kind of Habermas on your work and thought. So I wonder if you could kind of unpack and expand the sort of Karl Spracklin approach to Habermas and leisure.
Well, Habermas's big idea is there are essentially kind of two rationalities in the world. They kind of operate differently at different kind of time periods. But in terms of kind of modernity, we have what he calls communicative rationality, which is where people discuss things and they come up with ideas about, you know, how laws operate and how science is meant to work and how universities develop. And then we have this other form of rationality called instrumental rationality or instrumentality that is kind of imposing very narrow boundaries over what we are allowed to discuss and how we talk to each other. So put simply, instrumentality is state bureaucracies. It's what Habermas calls juridification. And also global capitalism, you know, the bottom line, so where everything is reduced to a kind of a profit or loss. And in leisure, I think, historically, leisure experiences are something that make us human, that we all can carry these passions about the things that we enjoy, the things that we love. We really kind of get huge satisfaction from our leisure pursuits. But there's industries of people out there trying to convert every leisure activity out there into something that can be sold. So music shifts from being in pre-modern times a way of people getting together around the fire singing songs, becomes an iPod where you give all your money to Apple and Apple controls every kind of transaction that you make. And running around and being kind of playful becomes professional sport, where instead of running up and down and kicking a ball, you're actually just sat in a stadium watching other people kick a ball around. So at every point you see historically this shift from the communicative to the instrumental, and that's how I'm using Habermas's work. In the stuff on the Enlightenment and Universalism, I'm just an old-fashioned Marxist. I mean, I just think it's a diversion to kind of lose the truth. There is a truth, and it's our... We wouldn't be academics if we weren't trying to come to a truth about something about the world. And I think there's lots of useful ideas in postmodernism and post-structuralism, and some of the kind of challenges that have been made about the power of science and the power of authorities and the power of authorial voices is absolutely valid. And I'm all for those challenges. But the fact that we think those challenges are valid suggests that we have some kind of ontology where we can still say this is good for the world and this is bad for the world. So for me, it's bad for the world that capitalism has got us trapped in the way that we're trapped. And I think it's bad for the world that white people still have all their power, and it's bad for the world that the gender order still exists. And it would be good for the world if those things were challenged and somehow kind of overturned or changed or evolved somewhere. So I think it's dangerous if you become completely post-structuralist about something like race, you end up saying, oh yeah, well, race, there's nothing real here to worry about. There's nothing, there's no real power. White people, black people are kind of equally able to create a kind of space where they're free and have that agency. And I'm not quite sure that that's always true, always, all the time. I think white people do have more power and do have more agency because historically, the white people have been in control.
I mean, it's really interesting because that sort of ethical moment, I guess, is what animates the case studies. But before you get into the case studies, you also try and probe both the question of sort of what is whiteness and then theories of whiteness more kind of generally. And I suppose it's really difficult, isn't it, to talk about, on the one hand, kind of whiteness and white people, but also, to be aware of and to make the point that this is a kind of constructed, socially developed idea that has a role in particular forms of exploitative practice. Oh, sorry.
No, No, carry on.
I guess the kind of the interesting question that follows from that attempt to theorise these issues is, well, how does this play out in sort of in leisure generally? And you've got examples from popular culture, music, sport, sports media, everyday leisure, tourism, outdoor leisure. And I think it'd be interesting if we picked up on a few of those. So, for example, one of the chapters you get into popular culture as a kind of key site for understanding whiteness through things like Harry Potter, Star Trek, Friends, and the Western canon. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Harry Potter, well, you've only got to look at the films, have they kind of sell this vision of multiculturalism on the one hand. So they do have characters who aren't white, but the key characters, Harry Potter, white, Hermione Granger, white, Ron Weasley, white. I see, I know them all. And they're not just white, they represent a kind of a mythologically white British public school culture. So Harry Potter sells this kind of this white Britishness, this kind of post-imperial white Britishness, and makes it normal and says it's not about elitism, and it's not about exclusion. Oh, because we've got these characters. There's the sisters, the Patel sisters over there, and there's Harry Potter's girlfriend who is Chinese, and you know that for Hollywood is their attempt at convincing people that they're diverse, but of course Harry Potter isn't about diversity. It's actually quite elitist, and it's about elite schools, and it's about the British public school. It's about the empire and Britishness, and the whole story revolves around people who are blood of the right blood to be magicians. Friends is just incredibly white. This is New York. In the 1990s and the 2000s, at a time when New York is incredibly diverse, and all the friends are white, and black African Americans occasionally kind of appear, but even when African Americans appear, they kind of choose actors who kind of carry that middle-class bourgeois cultural capital. And whenever there is a minority ethnic character who is African-American, it's always someone who's scary. You know, it's the scary criminal. It's the person threatening Chandler in a dark alley. The other two... Star Trek. Let's talk Star Trek. I love Star Trek. Star Trek is absolutely fantastic, and yet they were the first television program to air an interracial kiss between Captain Kirk and Uhura.
But you also point out the way that the power structures in Star Trek until, Deep Space Nine? There isn't the kind of, I guess, a senior black officer.
Yeah.
Within the kind of the world of Star Trek until...
Yeah.
It gets its third televisual iteration.
Yeah, so they do push the boundaries, but they push the boundaries, 20, 30 years too late.
I mean, one of the things that it's interesting you mentioned there is the intersection of questions of class and ethnicity. And, I mean, when I kind of encounter Harry Potter, it's interesting that kind of the question of whiteness or racialized discourses isn't the thing I think of as a predominantly sort of middle-class white British academic. What strikes me about it is the question of class and the kind of British obsession with class and how this has played out in Potter. But it was really sort of refreshing to see Potter framed in terms of the kind of ethnic and racialized discourses of things like, you know, the particular blood, you know, the racial lineage, etc., etc.
Yeah. I mean, all the talk in Harry Potter about mudbloods and about muggles, it's all kind of legitimizing these notions that there is such a thing as race, and there is such a thing where some person's blood means that they're somehow better than someone else.
I mean, at the same time as the question of sort of representation occurs in terms of maybe the sort of inequalities of presenting New York as a space dominated by white middle class individuals, there's also a question of kind of how one teaches particular forms of consumption and the idea of the white consumer in that chapter.
Yeah, the whole kind of idea of the central perk, where if you're bourgeois, young, urban, white, you kind of perform this role where you hang around with your friends instead of your family. You don't seem to work because you're kind of rich enough to not worry about paying the bills. And even the act of drinking coffee is a kind of a post-colonial trick. You know, coffee's history is kind of littered with, you know, the story of empire and the story of slavery and the story of global capitalism, and coffee is still this kind of incredibly unequal product. But it's kind of it's normalized as part of everyday popular culture without a moment's thought of the kind of the inequalities and the historical inequalities that have kind of led to that moment when Rachel's sitting down with a latte next to Monica.
And yeah, you do this this same kind of or similar analysis in the chapter on whiteness and everyday leisure, where you think about, you know, the activities of drinking, shopping, eating, constructed categories of what we might refer to as ethnic food carry these same sorts of problematic issues.
Yeah, ethnic food really troubles me, and I say that ironically because my favourite food is actually a curry. But I think the whole notion of going for a curry and going for ethnic food is just ridiculous when you kind of look at it closely, because who are these ethnic people with their ethnic food? It's minority ethnic people, it's marginalised groups, it's migrants, and it's the other, you know, so we instantly kind of exoticise an entire community on the basis that we quite like their food. And, you know, we then turn that community into a service industry. We then kind of engage with people from that community whilst they're serving us the food. And then we kind of disappear and go to our nice white houses in our kind of nice white towns. So I find the idea of ethnic food deeply problematic, because I've never seen anywhere, I've never been anywhere where I've seen, actually, I was going to say I've never been anywhere where I've seen ethnic British food portrayed as ethnic food, but I think if you go to Spain, you'll probably find some of those bars on the kind of Spanish resorts where they probably have British fish and chip shops. So I better stop talking there before I contradict myself.
But it's interesting that kind of the role of something like, say, curry, which is, you know, in the British popular imagination, framed as being Indian or subcontinental Indian food, but actually it's got this complicated history of dialogues between Britain, its empire, the subcontinent, and contemporary Britishness, particularly the discussion of who is involved in its making, you know, the particular varieties of curry that we associate with India, but actually, you know, importantly, kind of from places like Bangladesh. These kinds of questions are missing from that kind of exoticization in the popular imagination.
Yeah, and what's also missing is the fact that people from the British Asian community just eat a whole variety of food the same as everyone else. And most of the kind of young people, if you go around an area that's kind of predominantly British Asian, you'll find most of the kind of young people on the street are just eating fried chicken like every other working class young person in Great Britain. And yet there's a kind of, there's an assumption that, you know, everybody there must be eating curry because curry is the thing that they've given us that we, the white people in charge, are comfortable with.
So this question of, I guess what the sort of critical moments might be in the study of things like everyday life, you do try and, I guess, kind of salvage some of these critical moments with an appeal to these kind of ideas about communicative rationality. And one of the things that stood out in the book was the discussion of online gaming, particularly a game you focus on called World of Warcraft, and how there might be a kind of a utopian or communicative moment here, but actually how it gets thwarted.
Yeah, I think with all activities, there's always the chance for engagement, dialogue, discourse, and the construction of more inclusive identities and communities. And kind of counter-hegemonic, resistive communities. And I think the internet and gaming is possibly a place where that could happen. So, you know, there might be on World of Warcraft opportunities for people to mess around with gender, to mess around, to develop connections with people from around the world, from lots of different communities, and have like a intercultural dialogue. But of course, in reality, what often happens with these sorts of games is they just reproduce the existing kind of racial hierarchies and gender orders.
Now, the other thing, aside from computer gaming, where these kind of questions of communicative rationality and utopia come in a quite sort of, I guess, sort of depressing way, because they're so marginal, are the two chapters about sport, one of which covers questions about sports participation, particularly how some sports are kind of coded as white sports and some sports are coded as black sports, but then also the overall political economy of sports media and sports politics.
Yeah, I gave them two chapters because for most people today, when you talk about leisure, most people think of sports instantly as one form of leisure that's kind of so globalized, so universal across so many different kind of nations and cultures. So I felt it needed kind of two chapters to kind of tackle sport. And there is a strong relationship, I think, between, you know, the idea of sports as participation activities, whether you're playing or you're a fan, and, you know, the sports media complex, each kind of feeds off each other. But I think in both places, because the history of sport, the history of modern sports, is that sports were modern sports were constructed at the end of the 19th century, there or thereabouts, by Western imperialists, people who were making explicit their commitment to preserving empire, promoting the white race, promoting the community of European nations and promoting kind of elitism and promoting masculinity. Because our modern sports come from there, they still carry this doctrine, I guess, this doctrine of hegemonic whiteness. They are there merely to kind of keep the working classes and keep the other in check and nurture the well-being of the elites. Now, since then, of course, sport has been commodified, commercialized, professionalized, and turned into a global industry where actually the bottom line counts more than the preservation of white power. So profit is kind of the main driver of professional sports and the sports media complex now. But there are these echoes of this elitist discourse that survive today. So the notion that some sports are for white people and some sports are for others, the notion that black people are somehow a race that is kind of physically superior, so it means they can do certain sports, which of course is a nonsense, because there's no kind of scientific evidence for any of that. And the idea that sport is a way of perpetuating nationalism, this kind of still, even with the Olympics in 2012, when Mo Farah was an emblem, supposedly, of British multiculturalism, it was still bracketed in this imperialist idea of Britain, you know, the Queen parachuting out of the plane. We're still living in a nation state that, you know, believes in the power of the monarchy and this kind of intrinsic right to rule. So, you know, we are not a democratic nation, we're not a multicultural nation, we're still subjects of the Queen and subject to her arbitrary rule.
The final two things that I'd like to flag up and maybe have a chat about just as we come to the end of the discussion are the idea of intersectionality, which has become really important for contemporary feminist discourse, which I think ran sort of throughout the book, although it becomes really important for one of the later chapters on everyday life, as you kind of discuss the way intersections of class, gender, race crossover. And then also your presence in the book as well, which unusually for a book that, you know, is kind of theoretically inclined with empirical case studies, there are moments in the book where you yourself appear as, you know, a reader, as a consumer of music, as someone who, you know, goes walking around the part of the UK in which you live.
Yeah, I made a deliberate choice to impose my kind of authorial voice throughout the work, even kind of reflecting on my own ideas at times. And yeah, it's not a normal academic book, and I think some reviews have kind of critiqued it for having too much of that first-person reflective stuff that for some people might just be self-indulgent nonsense. But I think politically and ethically, it's a kind of a lie to withdraw yourself from your own ideas and your own research. And lots of work that I read, actually, aesthetically, it's not written very well, because people are trying to avoid saying, oh yeah, I've written this because I'm a football fan and I enjoy writing about football. So I think it's kind of important that particularly in leisure studies, where we are writing about the things that might seem a bit kind of trivial or frivolous, I think it's important that we are kind of open to our own position, our own kind of interest in the field. I also think it does come from that, from a kind of a feminist epistemology. From here at kind of Leeds Metropolitan, you know, we've got a long tradition of leisure scholars writing out of that feminist epistemology, and I just want to kind of keep on being part of that endeavour. You know, as a man, as a white man, as a middle class white man, I want to kind of just keep coming back to that fact and that problem. It's not going to suddenly make me into something else, but as you know, it shows the reader, I think, that you know, I do take these things home with me, and it's not just, you know, writing a book, putting it on the shelf, and then going home and replicating the problems that I've just critiqued.
Yeah, and that comes up quite obviously in your discussion of things like folk music and particular forms of metal, and some of the brilliantly named bands that you mentioned in the chapter on music. But I think that might be a kind of a moment to ask you what sort of future projects are there, both within, I guess, that kind of critical tradition, but also as part of the leisure studies series.
Well, I'm writing a book at the moment about digital leisure, trying to map that Habermasian public sphere onto the internet, which Habermas himself famously has kind of dismissed. I mean, he's not a big fan of the internet. And I'm trying to kind of just use this tension between agency and power to explore beyond the things that I wrote in Whiteness and Leisure. So it's more kind of, so the sections in there that are about the net, it's kind of it's a full thing. So there'll be a chapter on commodified leisure, a chapter on downloading, a chapter on pornography. So that's kind of my main work at the moment. In terms of music, I'm doing a piece of research on folk metal and masculinity and nationalism. So trying to kind of unpick the myths and the narratives at work in this kind of folk metal genre, which is kind of died a death. It was incredibly popular about 3 years ago. Now, most bands are either disowning the genre or disappearing from the scene altogether, but I'm still writing about them. I'm also, I've got about a dozen other projects on the go, all at various stages of planning. I'm hoping to write something around heritage tourism and northernness. I've got a special issue of the Journal for Cultural Research coming out in 2016 or 17, so it's a long way away. I want to kind of return to this idea of northernness that I've kind of used in quite a lot of my work, and just really have a go at kind of critiquing that and developing a theoretical framework to use in future projects. And I'm also writing about more stuff on Morris dancing, looking at pagans and radical feminists and other kind of alternative types and countercultural types, and how they use Morris dancing as a kind of a space for kind of resisting the mainstream.
Great. I mean, we'll have to get you back on the podcast as these projects develop and get published. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk about Whiteness and Leisure with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we spoke to Professor Carl Spracklin from Leeds Metropolitan University in the UK about his new book, Whiteness and Leisure, which was published by Palgrave in 2013.